Hello, my name is Andy Bomick, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program, or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the July 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article about a girl group that I wasn't familiar with, which is an interview with the members called The Roaches. And also a countdown of Oasis' greatest songs and a classic album review of For the Roses by Joni Mitchell. We begin with the Mojo Eyewitness, the magical world of The Roaches. Harmonizing New Jersey siblings with a punk name, The Roaches had been signed up by Paul Simon, but wouldn't cooperate. Then Robert Fripp saw them in 1978 and was blown away. A major label deal and critical adoration promised the big time, but attempts to smooth off their edges and unwise support slots meant a breakthrough was not to be. Nothing superfluous had to be added to the Roaches, because they are the Roaches. They reflect, "I can't believe we did what we did." Terry Roach. My older sister Maggie was an exceptional human being with an amazing ear for harmony. When we were 11 and 12, after the Beatles hit the U.S. in 1964, we began playing along with our nylon-stringed guitars to instructional TV show Folk Guitar with Laura Weber, and developed a repertoire. Later, we auditioned for the radio show Izzy Young at the Folklore Center, where Dave Van Ronk heard us. His wife, Terry Thigh, who'd managed Bob Dylan, took us out of high school to perform at college campuses all over the country, and told us of a songwriting class Paul Simon was teaching at NYU. Maggie approached Paul and played him some songs, but he told her we were nowhere near ready and asked Maggie, "Do you think you're as good as a songwriter as Paul McCartney?" And she said yes. She'd already written Pretty and High, later released on the Roaches' eponymous 1979 LP, when she was a teenager. It always blew my mind, her insight into that situation when she hadn't even had a boyfriend yet. Here's a little bit of that song, Pretty and High by the Roaches.
She came on the stage in a dress like the sky. Had painted a sunset around her eyes, and all of the people were charmed and surprised how pretty and high and shy she was, pretty and high and shy. She at the window and the prince upon the bed. They were for an hour before he said, if she had no place else, she was welcome to stay. But she better.
Maggie Roach. Paul Simon was an early hero of mine. He really helped us get set up. Terry. Paul signed us to his production company. We sang backup on his There Goes Ryman Simon album and made our debut album as Maggie and Terry Roach, 1975's Seductive Reasoning for Columbia. They sent us to Muscle Shoals to record, and we had to fight to pay our own guitars on the album. They were used to having session musicians make commercial-sounding tracks for radio, and it was still a very male-dominated industry. Even Joni Mitchell and Carly Simon had guys playing the music. We felt defeated, so we told Paul we wouldn't promote the record and went down to Hammond, Louisiana, where a friend had started a kung fu temple. We gave up playing music, but that's where Maggie wrote Hammond's song about that experience. I was 21, and I felt like a complete has-been. A year later, we returned to New York and tended bar at legendary Greenwich Village Folk Club Folk City. Susie was studying, and when she'd visit us in the city that winter, we'd all sing a cappella Christmas carols at bars and in the streets. And here's some of that song, Hammond's Song, by the Roaches. Rosenberg. I love them for that. Who else would sing Christmas carols in New York? They really committed to it. Terry. We thought that was pretty good, and after Christmas started performing our own songs. Folk City owner Mike Porco said, "You've got to develop a following. Everyone knows you as Maggie and Terry Roach. So you must perform as the Roach Sisters." But we didn't want back into the music business, so we played under a different name every time. Eventually, we settled on the Roaches. Punk was happening, so everyone assumed we were a punk group. The Roaches sounded pretty punk. We weren't punks, but they were doing whatever they wanted, and so were we. We weren't trying to be commercial or folk music. We were just doing the music we wanted in our own little space. Elizabeth Rush. I called to ask to be their agent. Susie answered, and there was a miscommunication, and she told them, "There's a woman on the phone who says she's our agent." And the other two said, "Well, if she feels that way, then she's our agent." Everything about them appealed to me. Their clothes, their lyrics, their onstage patter. Liz. They were sort of from another planet. Greenwich Village girls. Undergroundish. Authentic. They were quirky and appealing. Bohemian in a great way. Maggie was always very quiet, but they were joyous together. Talk about a harmonic convergence. Elizabeth. When they started getting popular in the village, women began dressing like they did. Their look was, "Well, put on what we feel like wearing, and we don't care." They wore high-top sneakers. They were not a folk group, in my mind. They were unique, contemporary. Terry. Maggie had written most of the early songs, but now Susie and I started writing. I was the nonfiction writer in the group. My first song, Runs in the Family, was about getting an abortion when I was younger. And Mr. Selleck was about quitting my job in a diner and then having to ask for it back. After the record came out, the real Mr. Selleck told me, "You could have at least mentioned the name of the restaurant." And here's a little bit of that song, Mr. Selleck, by the Roaches.
Oh, Mr. Selleck, can I have my job back? I've run out of money again. Last time I saw ya, I was singing hallelujah. I'm so glad to be leaving this restaurant. Now the only thing I want is to have my old job back again.
Susie Roach. One day we were singing on the streets of New York City, and soon we were on stage in the clubs around Greenwich Village, and then a record deal. Robert Fripp. In 1978, New York Times critic John Rockwell told me to see the Roaches. I saw them at the Bottom Line and was blown away. They were real. They were true. They were a force of nature. Warners were signing them, and I knew the Roaches would get screwed over. That the label would add drums and keyboards. My approach was to protect them and translate the reality and truth of the Roaches' live experience onto record. My job interview was terrifying. I made my pitch, and they said nothing, stone-faced. But my application was successful. Susie Roach. We didn't really know who he was, to be honest. Robert. I had them sit around the microphone and perform live. My approach was audio vertite, which wasn't fully welcomed by Warners because it had no bells and whistles. There was a little bass. I added a guitar solo to Hammond's song. Terry. Robert didn't want to play on the album, but we talked him into it. Robert. I wasn't even the first take. It was a mic check. The engineer, Ed Sprigg, knew how to keep the tape rolling at all times. My guitar slides into a D below Terry's E-flat vocal and then slides away again, which conventionally should be excruciating. But that particular juxtaposition just tweaks the heart. Anita Lingolt. When I hear Hammond's song today, the music, the voices, and Fripp's guitar are so perfectly, hauntingly beautiful, it still mesmerizes me. Terry. People expected this bombastic production. I remember visiting Warner's, and one of the secretaries said, "Oh, I really like your demo tape." And I had to explain, "No, that's the finished album." Robert. Maggie said, "It's not as loud as other records." And no, it wasn't over-compressed or EQ'd to smack you in the face. That would lose the subtlety and the truth of it. And the album still wrenches my heart when I listen to it. It's astonishing. Liz, the press was madly in love with them. They were revered. Terry, the album was voted Record of the Year by the New York Times, but it did not get on commercial radio. Mo Osteen, president of Warner, said, "Good start. You sold 200,000 records, but you have to get on the radio with the next one." James Taylor asked us to open for him in 25,000-seat stadiums, but we turned him down, and Warner's got mad. "You're not interested in working." Then we got offered 2 weeks with Boss Skaggs, playing 6,000-seat places. We said yes, and the tour was brutal. Every night we'd get booed off stage, objects and insults thrown at us, and end up crying afterwards backstage. It was humiliating. Anita, they'd done tours of small venues on their own, and they'd been great. Van Halen came out to see them in Memphis and loved them. But my instinct was that the Skaggs tour wouldn't work, and they were screamed at. That was hard for the Roaches to take from a human perspective. They were women going against the tide, and it was not an easy road. When they played San Francisco on that tour, the audience was so loud and unaccepting, they couldn't even stay on the stage. They walked off after 4 songs. Maggie took it hardest. She was the essence of songwriting. She took what she did very seriously because she was putting herself out there and was so sensitive to the vibes coming back. Susie, we were under pressure to try and comfort to a sound that was commercial. Terry, Susie wrote the song Nerds after that tour as a real reaction to that feeling of you're not part of the in crowd. Warner's wouldn't allow us to use Fripp on the Nerds album. So we hired Roy Haley, who brought in Fred Smith from television and J.D. Daughtry from Patti Smith's band. We added bass and drums and pumped things up for radio, and I thought we'd get played for sure. Susie was more skeptical, and she was right. I love when people tell me Nerds is their favorite Roaches record. It has so much soul. But when Nerds sold less than the debut, Warner's let us use Fripp again for our third album as a trio. Keep on doing. And here's a little bit of that song, Nerds, by the Roaches.
I'm so glad I am one.
Robert, I approached the project the same as with the first record. Nothing superfluous had to be added to the Roaches because they are the Roaches. We have some microphones. We have the Roaches. So here we go. Terry, A lot of times, artists double-track their harmonies. Fripp's concept for Keep On Doing was to triple-track ours. It gave the harmonies an almost choir-like sound, but also this fierceness. I remember a reviewer saying it sounded like heavy metal folk because it had this driving energy. Susie, the harmonies were just so unconventional and yet very powerful. It was a physical sensation. Terry, we recorded 1985's Another World, the album after Keep On Doing, with Warners on the verge of dropping us throughout. After that, we recorded further albums on a series of labels. I'm very proud of all the Roaches records. We always insisted on creative control. That was our deal breaker. And I love listening to our records. I can't believe we did what we did. It was an extremely male-dominated art form when we were doing it. Later, you had things like Lilith Fair. But there was nothing like that in the 70s. Susie used to say we were like the cow catcher at the front of a locomotive, clearing the tracks for everyone who came after us. Susie, I am surprised and grateful for the listeners for whom our music resonated deeply. Some misunderstood us, thinking we were a novelty act. The Roaches operated on many levels, and some people really got that. Terry, Maggie died in 2017 of breast cancer, on the day Donald Trump was inaugurated. I think about that. She didn't want to go through all this. She cut out before this. There's a comfort in still being able to hear Maggie's voice on our records. There's such a tremendous amount of meaning in her writing and her life. When we finished making The Roaches, Fripp told me, "You guys are going to influence a lot of people, but you're probably not going to benefit from it yourselves." And that's what happened. And now, the 50 greatest Oasis songs. Of course, we don't have time for all 50 songs in this article, but I will play the top songs. This article is titled, "It's Just Rock and Roll." Few bands are called to carry the burden, or so it seems, of the aspirations of a generation. Fewer still have carried it as lightly, or so it seems, as Oasis. From 1992, the moment Noel Gallagher joined his brother Liam's band, rock and roll alchemy was at work. On the surface, they appeared a product of their environment, 80s Manchester, combining the yearning of the Smiths and the swagger of the Stone Roses. So far, so indie. Soon, however, it was clear that the singer and the songs expressed something at once fresher and more atavistic. The melodic appeal of the Beatles, the razor intent of the Sex Pistols. Appreciated by connoisseurs, they would quickly cross over to the Olé Polé, a band for everyone, or nearly. You saw Oasis and were changed. They didn't move on stage. They weren't here to integrate or entertain. The sound of the original band, the irreducible rumble of Paul Bonehead Arthurs on rhythm guitar, Tony McCarroll on drums, Paul Gingsley McGuinn on bass, gave no quarter. Noel brought structure, savvy, ridiculous tunes. Liam's voice cut through it all with passion and power, an articulation of young working-class Britain, its hopes and fears, betrayals and defiance. There was always turbulence, Noel's demands on the band, the demands of his songs. Saul, the back of McCarroll, then Goonsley and Bonehead. Alan White brought the shuffle, then made way for Zach Starkey's thunder. Jem Archer and Andy Bell joined the ranks and wrote songs. Meanwhile, Liam and Noel sparred constantly. A fraternal soap opera of insults, walkouts, no-shows, smash guitars. Yet, when a final severance was announced on August 28, 2008, it was just the start of constant rumors of a reunion. When fans gather for the first of the summer Oasis shows, it will be with trepidation, but also intense excitement, beyond a commitment to rock and roll sound, tradition, attitude, and behavior. Oasis are about a unique songbook, uniquely sung. On what pages will their set list alight? Here's 50 that Mojo will be shouting for. And voted number one, Live Forever. The first real song Noel Gallagher wrote was Live Forever. He revealed in the 2016 Oasis documentary, Supersonic. He added that it was also the first good song he wrote. More than that, it was a pivotal moment in both the band's recording history and the musical timeline of the 1990s. Live Forever changed everything. And here's a little bit of that song by Oasis, Live Forever.
Maybe I don't really wanna know how you got engrossed, 'cause I just wanna fly. Lately, did you ever feel the pain in the morning rain as it soaks you to the bone? Maybe I just wanna fly, wanna live but don't wanna die. Maybe I just wanna breathe. Don't believe, maybe you're the same as me. We see things I'll never see. You and I are gonna live forever. I said maybe I don't really wanna know how you got it wrong, 'cause I just wanna fly.
Sometimes when he writes songs, Noel will play around with the chords or a melody on his guitar for weeks, months, for years even, not getting anywhere with it. Other times the song will fall out from the heavens into his lap fully formed. That's what happens with the best songs, he always says. Live Forever, which is unquestionably among his best songs, is one where both of those things happened. For a while, after leaving school at 15, Noel and his brothers worked for their dad, who had a business doing concrete floors. It was, says Noel, the worst thing in the world. You can't do anything right working for your dad. They spent days on end in the back of a yellow transit van, being ferried from building job to job, bickering until Noel quit. He then got a job with a building firm who subcontracted to British Gas, which is where, unbelievably, the future of British guitar music was shaped. On one day, while working on the British Gas site, a fat steel cap fell off a heavy gas pipe they were laying and landed on Noel's foot, smashing it to bits. He was laid off sick for a good while. When he returned to the site, he was given a job in the storeroom handing out bolts and wellies. It was not taxing work and allowed him lots of solitary Noel time. Nobody turned up for days, he recalled happily. After a month or so, there, he decided to bring his guitar in. To help pass the time. I look at the foot sometimes in the winter when I get chills in it because of the cracked bones, and I give it a thumbs up, says Noel. I wrote 4 of the songs for the first album in that storeroom. The first song he wrote in there was Live Forever, though it wasn't called that, or called anything, then, but he came up with the melody, the outline. I have songs that are in cold storage for years, and I know they are great. I know I'm going to finish them one day, but I'm not going to rush it. It's going to fall out of the sky. I'm not going to just write it for the sake of it. That's why I have a backlog that need a first verse or a middle 8, but they are essentially fully formed. And voted number 2 Oasis song by Mojo Magazine, Acquiescence, 1995. It means more than family. Of course, Noel has denied it's about brotherhood, explaining that those pleading fraternal call and response vocals only exist because Liam couldn't get the high notes of the chorus, so I decided to sing it. But Acquiescence feeds off its dual identities. It's an uplifting cry of desperation, a reluctant love song about needing more than wanting. And in the euphoria of the brothers' dual delivery, it's obvious that their object of needful affection isn't each other, it's the band itself. And here's a little bit of that song, Acquiescence, by Oasis. Number 3, Slide Away, from Definitely Maybe, 1994, Oasis' first and arguably best out-and-out love song. Written on the Les Paul gifted to him by Johnny Marr, Slide Away was initially an attempt by Noel to write a song in the vein of Neil Young's Cortez the Killer. While you can hear some of that in the crackle and spark of guitars, it's Liam's tender, vulnerable delivery that makes Slide Away so spine-tingling. Tellingly, the only recording that made it onto Definitely Maybe from the aborted Minot Valley sessions, Noel still considers it his brother's best ever vocal. And here's some of that song, Slide Away by Oasis.
Today,
voted number 4, Supersonic, from Definitely Maybe 1994, An Immediate Manifesto. The past is yours, the future ours. At Liverpool's Pink Museum Studio, to relieve a buildup of frustration, attention turned to an old soundcheck jam. 11 hours later, Supersonic's demo was done. Its rolling momentum, carried by what engineer Angel Dutt described as compressed chainsaw guitars. So undeniable that it became Oasis' debut 45, Untouched. The lyric Noel wrote just as spontaneously defined the inescapable excitement of their arrival, and the defining bullishness of Liam's character. You can have it all, but how much do you want it? And here's some of the song Supersonic by Oasis from the album Definitely Maybe. Voted number 5 by Mojo Magazine, Champagne Supernova, from What's the Story, Morning Glory, 1995, a psychedelic masterpiece of mixed emotions, written alone, unless you grant cocaine a co-credit, in the wake of a messy night at the Landmark Hotel in London. Champagne Supernova is the quintessential 90s expression of ambivalent excess. The psychedelic paradox of heavy limbs and racing brain, success as both celestial explosion and crushing landslide. The bittersweet taste of untenable triumph. Amid its euphoria lurks a premonition of aftermath. Paul Weller's frenzied guitar solo crowns the view from the top when the only way is down. And here's a little bit of Champagne Supernova by Oasis from the album What's the Story, Morning Glory.
Special people change. How many lives are living strange? Where were you while we were getting high? Slowly walking down the hall, faster than a cannonball. Where were you while we were getting high? Someday you will find me caught beneath the landslide. A champagne supernova in the sky. Someday you will find me caught beneath the landslide. In a champagne supernova.
champagne supernova in the sky. Up the dawn and ask her why. A dream, she never dies. Wipe that tear away now from your.
Voted number 6, Rock and Roll Star, from Definitely Maybe, 1994. A Pache powered roar sets the band agenda. As every motivational book tells us, we are what we think about. From Song 1, Album 1, Oasis, we're thinking about being massive. Appropriately, this is a towering guitar-nado, with flashes of Mott, Lizzy, and AC/DC, and Liam's pure beam of confidence pushed through that Lennon-Lydon filter. It's so cocky. It just repeats the first verse twice before spiraling out in a minute-long maelstrom. It's just rock and roll, Liam shouts, of the best kind. And here's some of that song, Rock and Roll Star by Oasis, from Definitely Maybe. Voted number 7, Top Oasis Songs by Mojo Magazine, Cigarettes and Alcohol, from Definitely Maybe, 1994. Hedonism as heroism. The whole song is a joke, Noel said later, dismissing any suggestion of social anemia in the lyrics as overanalysis. Irony notwithstanding, there's no pure distillation of the band's hedonistic credo than their fourth single. It's about escaping to a life in the sun, sheeny, shiny, drinking, smoking, having it. That their innocent ambition quickly turned into the less charming reality of rock star excess hasn't severed the song's pan-generational connection to aspirant youth. Here's a little bit of the song, Cigarettes and Alcohol, from Oasis. We'll be right back. Number 8, Going Nowhere, B-side, 1997. Pre-Oasis, musing on the riches fame might bring. This wistful Noel solo nugget, dipped once more in doleful Bacharach horns and easy listening strings, was taped in the aftermath of the Be Here Now sessions. Its sense of sadness and wonder stems in part from it being misfiled in the Oasis chronology, reportedly. Noel crafted it in 1990 out of then unattainable pop star aspirations, being a millionaire, owning a Jaguar. Now, though he's rich as Croesus, you can feel the gray pre-fame memory of growing older in the rain that remains in his heart, in his hurt locker. And here's part of the song, Going Nowhere, from the B-side, 1997. Number 9, Columbia, from Definitely Maybe, 1994. Do you remember the first time? Trailed on White Label promo in December 1993, Columbia was the first hit outside of Oasis gigs of what was around the corner. On the far superior Definitely Maybe version, its job is simply to overload. It's a guitar riff riding a tornado that's torn up everything, including Acid House and the Chameleons' Swamp Thing. The lyric about a feeling too strange and wonderful to be described encapsulates the band's extraordinary promise. In Oasis, rock and roll would be made new. Here's part of the song, Columbia, by Oasis. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for Oasis Top 50 Songs, so we have enough time for the classic album review, which this week is For the Roses by Joni Mitchell. In 1972, Joni Mitchell released the follow-up to her highly acclaimed Blue. Blue is an album famed for its lyrical sincerity concerning issues deeply personal to Joni's life. On For the Roses, Joni offers an emotionally much more subdued album. Lyrically, her album deals with her cynical approach to the music industries. For the Roses, You Turn Me On, I'm a Radio, The Ills of Capitalism, Banquet, as well as Detaching Herself and Narrating Other Stories, Cold Steel and Blue Fire. This creates an atmosphere that is perhaps more distant and not as accessible as Blue. But Joni's wonderful song craft carries this extremely strong album nonetheless. And here's a little bit of the song, You Turn Me On, I'm a Radio, from Joni Mitchell on the album For the Roses.
Driving into town with a dark cloud above you, dialing the number who's bound to love you. Oh, honey, you turn me on. I'm a radio, I'm a country station. I'm a little bit corny, I'm a wildflower waiting for you. Broadcasting tower waiting for you. And I'm sending you this signal here. Hope you can pick it up loud and clear. I know you don't like weak women, you get bored so quick. And you don't like strong women, cause they're hip to your tricks. It's been dirty for dirty down the line, but you know I come when you whistle and you're...
In particular, the arrangements on the album are sublime. The aforementioned Cold Blue Steel and Sweet Fire is a particular high. It features subdued guitar, bass, and drums with a soprano saxophone wailing over the top, somewhat blurring the lines between cheese and tastefulness, with a funky wah-wah guitar lingering in the background. The song's climatic moments are underpinned when a wonderful synth glissando that gives the song an almost pornographic quality, perfectly suited to the grimy heroin addiction over which Joni is lamenting. And here's some of that song, Cold Blue Steel and Sweet Fire by Joni Mitchell.
Cold Blue Steel out of money, one eye for the people police. Sweet fire calling, you can't deny me. Now you know what you need. Underneath the jungle gym, hollow gray fire escape thief. Looking for sweet fire, shadow of lady. I know the way, she says it's down, down, down the dark ladder. Do you wanna contact somebody first? Leave someone a letter.
And here's a little bit of the song, For the Roses, from Joni Mitchell, off her album of the same title.
Heard it in the wind last night, sounded like applause. Did you get around resounding for you way up here? Seems like many dim years ago since I heard that face to face, or seen you face to face. Though tonight I can feel you here. I get these notes on butterflies and lilac sprays from girls who just have to tell me they saw you somewhere.
In many ways, Joni Mitchell's 1972 album For the Roses gets overlooked by the towering presence of the two giants sitting either side in her discography. However, the album provides some of Joni's most underrated work and is a worthy part of Joni's catalog, especially as part of her staggering chain of achievements between 1971 and 1976. Once again, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I read articles from the most current August 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. It seems appropriate with the recent passing of Ozzy Osbourne of Black Sabbath that I'm reading an article titled Into the Void, and then an article titled Be My Baby about Carla Thomas, and a classic album review of Sweethearts of the Rodeo by the Byrds. Until then, this is Andy Bommack for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.
Trembles as he sings and he asks some guy to circulate his soul around. On your mark, red ribbon runner, the caressing web of mortars finally turns.